My name is Sarah Ashwin and I'm a Professor of Comparative Employment Relations in the Department of Management, and I'm also Deputy Head of Department for Teaching. So I'm absolutely delighted to welcome three really inspiring speakers for tonight's event. They've come from a diverse range of personal and professional backgrounds. So starting on my right, we've got Stephanie Cutler, who is founder of Making Lemonade, which is an inclusion consultancy with a focus on disability equality. Then we've got Gary Heffernan, who's an entrepreneur currently, but before that he's worked for over 20 years as a senior managing director for communications, media and technology at Accenture. Well, I don't know if all the time he was at Accenture he was that senior, but he's had a long career there. And then on my far right-hand side, there's Abadesi Osunsade, who is a head of maker outreach at Product Hunt, a website that lets users share and discover new products. She's also head of a social enterprise, which I think she may talk about as well. So we live in a time when there's an expectation of equality in many aspects of our lives. Obviously, this was incorporated into law here in the UK with the Equality Act of 2010, which made it illegal to discriminate on the basis of age, race, gender identification, sexual orientation, religion, or disability. But as we all know, passing legislation is a really important landmark, but it's always a beginning of a further journey within organisations where issues about diversity and inclusion continue to be live, and we know from things like the gender pay gap, lack of integration of many groups, that these issues remain very salient and a big challenge for very many organisations. But tonight we're celebrating or marking International Women's Day a little bit early. It's coming on Sunday, I believe, is International Women's Day. And to mark that, our speakers will share experiences of how equality has improved their lives and those around them. They'll be discussing their personal journeys and providing practical insights into how to make equality and autonomy a reality. I'm really delighted to say that for this event, we're partnering with Her Equality Rights and Autonomy, HERA, and we can see them here in the front row, and I think possibly with the yellow scarves. And they'll be, so it's a charity which works with women survivors of trafficking, conflict and other forms of violence, and young women vulnerable to trafficking and exploitation to pursue aspirations and ambitions for a better life. So we're really grateful for you for partnering us for that, for this event. For those of you who are on Twitter, the hashtag for tonight's event is Each for Equal. But if you have got a phone, please put it onto silent so we don't disrupt tonight's event. It is being recorded, so we'll hopefully make it available as a podcast if there aren't any technical difficulties. So we keep our fingers crossed on that. As usual, after the lecture, there'll be a chance for you to put questions to our panel. So what's going to happen is we're going to actually hear from them in turn. But at the end, I'll open it up to all of you for questions. I think we'll have plenty of time for questions because they're going to speak for about 15 minutes each. So without further ado, I will hand over to Stephanie.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for inviting me here today. Everybody has a story. And I think there's huge value in storytelling, and our lived experience is, you know, can be very valuable in terms of creating social change. So I'm going to share part of my story with you today and some of the insights that may be relevant to our conversations that we'll have this evening. So my story that I'm going to share with you starts when I was in my late 20s. I was working hard and playing hard down here in London. I was working as a fashion designer, which is what I'd always wanted to be ever since I was a little girl. And I took some leave from work and I went on holiday, and as part of a sightseeing trip we were on, we stopped off at an amusement park called Puzzling World. And part of Puzzling World, there was an optical illusion room, and one of the illusions had great big black lines painted down one big wall. So I followed the instructions, I closed one eye and I looked at the lines, and I closed the other eye and I couldn't see the lines at all. I thought, wow, that's pretty clever. And it wasn't until I got back in the car and I closed each eye separately that I realised actually I couldn't really see out of one of my eyes. But I was on holiday and I was having fun, so I didn't really give it too much further thought. And when I came back off holiday, I went back to work, to a huge pile of work, which often happens when you've been on holiday. But I had in the back of my mind, you know, I must go to the optician. So I eventually went in my lunch hour to the high street opticians, and she closed my eye. And I read the lettered chart right down to the tiny line at the bottom. She closed my other eye, and I couldn't see the chart at all. She was like, "You really need to go to the eye hospital." I was like, okay, I will. No, like, today, now, you need to go to the eye hospital. So I went, and several people took a look at my eyes, and nobody could really tell me too much, and so they suggested I'd need to see a consultant. That evening, I was recounting my day to my parents on the phone. There's no real alarm bells ringing for me. But unbeknown to me, at the other end of the line, the alarm bells were deafening. There was a condition within my family which I was less aware of than my parents. So the next morning, I was getting ready to go to work, as per usual, and I opened the door to my parents. Now, bearing in mind, I lived in London, they lived in the Midlands. I wasn't expecting to see them, and they broke down. And I thought, my first thought was that something awful had happened and that they had some bad news about my sister, who at the time was on honeymoon. But they came in and they broke down. They told me I was going to go blind. Now, I must be the only person, certainly that I've ever met, who took that news with relief, because I was so glad my sis was okay. I just thought, phew, it's just my eyes. That's okay. So, but it wasn't okay. Didn't go to work, we went to the hospital, had several other people take a look, and whilst it wasn't confirmed on that day, my symptoms and my family history meant it was pretty likely that, yeah, I was going to experience sight loss, and within a week I'd had a diagnosis that I was going to lose my central vision. Now, I didn't know what central vision loss meant. I didn't know what it would mean to me practically, and I didn't know what it would mean to me emotionally. But I really remember sitting in that hospital, making a very, very conscious decision that whatever central vision loss meant, it was not going to mean the end for Steph Cutler. And I vowed I would always stick to that. And I had no idea how. I loved my job, but I didn't really want to spend sort of the next few months looking at the four walls of work, so I took myself off to see a little bit of the world while I still could, and my good eyes started to deteriorate, and at that point my overall sight was affected and I did indeed lose my central vision. Of course it did affect me, it affected me practically and indeed emotionally, and I moved back home to my parents because I needed some support. About this time, I realised that sitting at home, learning to live with sight loss was never ever going to help me learn to live with sight loss. And that what I needed to do to learn to live with sight loss was to get out and about. And this was really difficult. It was really difficult practically, but what I had to do was just keep trying and trying, doing really small things and then building up, and eventually I'd put myself back on the train, come back down to London and see my friends, which was really challenging because I don't look blind. And so I needed to navigate and learn how to navigate and independently travel and get support I needed along the way in ways which suited me. And I was going back to see my friends, you know, living my old lifestyle, doing my old job, earning my old salary. And so it was difficult, but it became easier and easier. And about this time, I set myself a couple of goals. And my first goal was a short-term goal that I wanted to become employable again. I had years and years ahead of me, and I'd always been pretty ambitious, and work was important to me. And my second goal was longer term, and that I needed to turn things around, get them back to how they were. I got put in touch with a college local to me that specialised in supporting people with a vision impairment. And it was with great trepidation that I turned up on my first day because I did not know how they could help. I just knew they had to because I had no plan B. So I turned up on my first day for this day of assessments to see if they were able to support me. And I pretty much told everyone all day long, everyone who would listen to me, that they couldn't turn me away, that they had to help because I had no plan B. And by the end of the day, it was decided that there was an employability course which I was eligible for and that I was able to start on that, which would support me to get myself back to becoming employable, which was my first goal. However, there was a problem because the course was 6 weeks long and there was only 4 weeks left before the college was due to close for the summer. And I think I really had been so persuasive and so determined that they were a little bit too scared to turn me away because they agreed to keep the college open for a further 2 weeks in order for me to start the course. So I promptly cancelled my holiday and threw myself into this course, and it was the hardest thing today that I've ever had to do because I was learning how to use a computer, and I knew how to use a computer, but that was when I was fully sighted, and I had to learn how to use software which enables me to access the world of everything, actually. So I couldn't use the mouse because you can't see where to click and you can't see the keyboard and you can't see the screen. And so it was a really challenging time. But by the end of the summer, the time whereby I would have just been beginning that course, had I not been so determined and so persuasive and, yeah, so scary, I had achieved my first goal because I had become employable. It was a really difficult day, the day that I decided I wasn't going to go back to working in the fashion industry because that was what I had always wanted to do. But obviously it's a very visual job and it's very fast paced. So even with full sight, it was quite hard quite often to keep up. So it was a really difficult day when I decided, you know, that's not gonna be my forever job. But I woke up the next day and put things in perspective, and I still had a lot to offer. You know, I still had lots to give, and so I started applying for other jobs. It felt to me as though it didn't seem to count for quite so much. You know, my track record, I had a good CV, I had loads of enthusiasm, and it was disproportionately much more difficult for me to gain work. And that is the point that I started to feel really despondent and really fed up with my lot, because I had remained quite positive up until this point. You know, I'd acquired significant sight loss. I'd relocated, I'd retrained, I'd had to adapt to living with my new situation. And throughout that, I'd remained fairly positive, but I couldn't handle not being able to take that next step and get back into work and contributing. And so I decided that if people didn't want to give me a job, well, two fingers to them, I'd employ myself. And so I decided to set up my own business. I had been experiencing the barriers that many disabled people face, which previously I'd been really unaware of. And these barriers just make no sense to me at all. Like, why would you make it more difficult for me to spend my money with you? You know, it made no sense in a commercial sense, but it made no sense sort of morally, ethically, legally. It made no sense. So I decided to set up an organisation that would support employers and organisations to make their services more accessible. At this time, I got contacted by loads of people, particularly women, particularly disabled people, saying, you know, I'm struggling too, can you help me? And so I was obviously responding to everybody, but that was a full-time job in itself, and I was trying to set this business up. So I would respond to everybody, but realize that there was something there. There was people who needed other people. And so I combined both of those together in the end. There was a key point that I wanted to share with you where I learned about something called the social model of disability. And very briefly, the social model of disability says that it isn't always your impairment, your condition, that disables you in society. It's actually quite often something outside of you. So perhaps the way people treat you, the way society is structured, the way organizations have policies and practices that actually disable you more than the condition that you're living with. And this was a really liberating, quite a light bulb moment in my life, because that made a lot of sense to me. Because really, I was still Steph. You know, I still had aspirations. I still had a lot that I could give. And yet, just getting on with things, doing things, really everyday things, let alone anything exceptional, was definitely more difficult. And so that was a time that gave me an awful lot of confidence, because it told me there was a framework that said, it's not always you. So if it wasn't always me, then I should take confidence from that. And at that time, that was good timing, because I was about to start a business which I'd never done before, and run a business and work for myself, both of which were new to me. So that was a really good time to find out about that, because it gave me a real boost to my confidence. So I set up the organisation which I've been running for about 15 years, which is around making workplaces more inclusive, largely for disabled people, and supporting disabled people to get in and on in work. I don't think it's enough just to get in work, because actually what I realised was that I'd set my first goal wrong. It is one thing to be disabled and employable. It is actually something else to be, unfortunately still, it is something else to be disabled and employed. So I think it's really important that we make spaces and make it as inclusive as possible for disabled talent to get into work and then thrive in work. So that's kind of where I'm at and what I've been doing through sort of training and coaching for quite many, few many years now. And I just thought I'd share some of the insights in coming here today, because hindsight is a wonderful thing. You know, you can look back and just think about some of the key things that actually have made it possible for myself, or just really resonated and feels quite relevant for today. So the first is, I think that nobody achieves anything alone. I think we all need people around us at times to give us support and guidance. And that if you have a protected characteristic and that the pursuit of your goals is likely to be more difficult, then it's possibly even more important. And to have support and guidance from people with shared lived experience can be really, really helpful. I think it's really important to be true to yourself and your values. And I think that that is really easy to say. I'm sure you all believe that, you all agree with me. It is really easy to say, but actually I have found that it isn't always so easy to do. Systems and society are not always set up so as to make it easy to align your values with how you want to behave and your practices within workplaces, organizations, and so on. So it isn't always that easy to do. And I will be honest, I have sometimes lost having stuck to my values and my beliefs and who I am. I have definitely gained more than I've lost, but I have sometimes lost in doing that. I think it's really important that we stray out of our comfort zones at times, because comfort zones, by their very definition, are very comfortable places. And so to step outside of that causes discomfort. But I don't think individuals or organisations change unless they do stray from their comfort zones and try doing things differently. And so, you know, it's really important, I think, to scale yourself from time to time, because that's how you learn and you fail and you grow. And I think, you know, for me, I'd still be sitting in my mum and dad's old bedroom had I not done that. And that was a really small place to inhabit. So the more I got out and out and out, the more literally the world opened up and out to me, and I, you know, was aware and got opportunities that I just would never have been afforded otherwise. So I think there is just something where you have to challenge yourself from time to time, and even when it's really difficult for whatever reason, it's really important to strive. And then it's important, I think, because change is going on. Crikey, you don't need to look very far to see that, do you? You know, in the world, in the places that we live and work and study, change is just a constant thing. And sometimes change happens and you are not in control of that. You know, it's external to you and there's nothing that you can really do. That's the situation, you know, that I found myself in. Sometimes you don't have choice about what happens to you. Or that's certainly how it feels. But I do feel as though you have a choice as to how you react to things. So we can't always choose what happens to us, but we have choices around how we react. So I choose to see my sight loss as a gift. I choose to see it as a gift because actually it's given me lots that otherwise I just would never, ever have had. So I've met loads of people that I'd never have met before. You know, my friendship circles, my professional networks are so much more diverse now, and I really value that. There's been opportunities I would never otherwise have had. And I think in living as a disabled person, as a disabled woman, actually, you know, you have to innovate all the time. I'm always thinking, how am I going to do this? Because things are in the way. It's not so easy. So just in terms of how I operate, out of necessity, I have to think innovatively and I have to adapt all the time. And that brings with it a diversity of thought that I actually think is of great value to my professional work and my life in that respect. So I see my sight loss as a gift because without it, I just would not have had the experiences that I've had and the things. I wouldn't be stood here probably speaking to you guys and meeting some of you later. You know, it's definitely been a gift. And I'm not one of those always positive people that think every day this is a gift, you know. It doesn't feel like that. There are days when it's certainly extremely frustrating and I wish it came with a gift receipt and I could give it back, because there are certainly days when I would, and sometimes that's me, sometimes that's it, and sometimes that's them. That's the social model bit, you know. Sometimes it's how other things are structured so that actually it's not so easy, it's not so inclusive, it's not so welcoming. Those are my receipt days.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to say one further thing, and that is that my business, I have this saying, which is where the name came from, and that is help me through some of those dark days. That's if life deals you lemons, make lemonade. And I just want to wish you guys today all the best in making successful lemonade in whatever your fields are. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Steph. That was really inspiring.
I'm going to stand at the lectern because as an ex-LSE student, I always wanted to do this.
Oh, yeah.
The last time I was in this building was to sit my final year exams in 2009. So it's quite surreal to be here. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. I'm really excited to speak to all of you. I wish I could have told myself, my past self, that it would all work out okay, but I'm not sure I would have believed it, even if that had happened. Before I jump into things, I was just wondering how many of you are students, hands in the air? Okay. How many of you are thinking about how a lack of diversity might impact your ability to succeed in the workplace? Okay, cool. So quite a lot of you. Well, I've been asked to talk about how change or diversity has improved my life for the better. And what I wanted to talk about really was how once I arrived at a pivotal point in my career about 3.5 years ago and started to see the world through the lens of privilege and start to understand the role that structural oppression plays in our society, it started to make me feel a little less crazy and a little less like the freak in the room and the only person who was experiencing things like microaggressions and challenges at work. When I started to identify as an intersectional feminist and start to understand what that meant, it also opened up opportunities for me to join communities of other people and understand that, okay, we don't all experience the workplace in the same place and in the same way. So yeah, that was really amazing. So I'll just rewind a bit. I just told you I sat my final year exams in 2009. Well, what happened next? Global recession, very exciting time. I was fortunate to get a job at the Financial Times as an editorial intern, and that led to a full-time role in a financial publishing company. But even though I spent 2 years there, living it up in the city, I felt like I wanted to do something with a bit more impact. And that's what drew me into the tech world. And I was so happy to join Groupon in 2011 in the London office. It was growing so quickly, my team was doubling in size every month, and we were on a rocket ship towards our initial public offering, and I was convinced I was going to be a millionaire. It didn't quite work out that way. But after 3 years at Groupon, growing so quickly in the center of London, I found myself spoiled because we had such a diverse team because we didn't have a choice. We needed to bring in more salespeople, more customer service people, and London is a diverse city. You know, I often think of the diversity of London as being very well represented by a tube carriage or a bus. But then I found myself working at Amazon afterwards, and let's just say it wasn't as diverse as a London tube carriage there. And after a year at Amazon, I was poached by a startup, and I found myself in the most senior role I'd ever been in my career. I was extremely excited. But I was perplexed by the fact that although I had come in at a senior level and was compensated at that level, I didn't seem to have an equal voice at the table compared to my male counterparts and compared to my male peers. And when I'd take these issues to the pub and talk to my, you know, LSE buddies about it, other people who were in tech, most of whom were men, they would insist I wasn't doing it right. They were like, no, you need to say it this way, or you need to ask for it that way. And I would go back and I would do exactly what they said worked for them, and I would hit another wall and I would hit, a less successful outcome. And it really came to a head when I basically was harassed by someone in the company, raised it to a co-founder, and somehow I became the pariah. No one really believed me, no one really believed the story, and I quit my job with no next move planned. Now, the most messed up thing about that was that no one then wanted to give me a reference. Because no one believed me, I had basically been identified as a troublemaker. And very similar to Steph, since no one wanted to hire me, but London is very expensive, I decided to hire myself. And that's really how Hustle Crew was born. The very first idea I had was to create a space for other women in technology to talk about the blockers they faced in their careers. In my case, it was being managed out of a company because there was no way I could keep working there and be happy. In other people's cases, it was the fact that they asked for a promotion or a pay rise and were always told no. And the most perplexing thing was that when we invited men to participate in these conversations, none of them shared these experiences. Very similar to the Me Too movement, where all these women were like, oh my gosh, yes, I've had my ass grabbed in the tube, and all the men were like, funny, that never happens to me. So I suddenly started to realize that I had grown up believing a lie. And that lie was meritocracy. You know, I believed that if I worked really hard in the library and got my 2-1, which I did, I would be sorted for life. But the challenge with meritocracy is that it assumes we can equally access opportunities, and it assumes that we can equally maximize them. It also assumes that we do not face bias as we interact with hiring managers and recruiters. It also assumes that our identities don't give us earned or unearned, rather, advantages or disadvantages in society. And for me, being able to understand that it didn't matter if I was working as hard as everyone else and doing the utmost best I could, none of that mattered if the person who was deciding whether or not to bring me on this project or whether or not to promote me was sexist, that was like, thank God, because here I was thinking there was something wrong with me, but actually there's just something wrong with society, so that's fine. Now, once I started realizing that this was the case, I sort of poured myself into finding out everything I could about this. I was like, I want to know more about patriarchy. What does patriarchy mean? Oh, patriarchy means a system of government where men largely hold power and women are excluded from it. And I was like, oh my gosh, incredible. What does intersectional feminism mean? It means we want to pursue equal access to everything for all genders whilst understanding that systems of government, systems of society like police, like the judicial system that exist to keep the peace, are sometimes inherently oppressive themselves. And this was all just like mind-blowing, and I kind of wish I'd been learning about that while I was here. But hey, better late than never. And so what I tried to do with my social enterprise is go into tech companies and ask them why their teams are not diverse by default, and then help them start to understand why that is, help them start to understand structural oppression, and talk about what that actually means. Like, what is structural oppression? And it's like, hey, I've already defined patriarchy, but here's another fun topic, white supremacy. Let's talk about the fact that colonialization happened, and there are many people that still believe the white race is superior. And, you know, hearing Steph's journey as she became disabled is another incredible thing, because I never even thought about things like accessibility until I myself became a campaigner for more inclusive workspaces. So, you know, I'm just sort of giving you an overview of the work that I do and giving you an overview of the power that prioritizing diversity and inclusion can have in your life. There's no point shying away from it. Ultimately, it's a tool. You know, people are afraid of the word privilege because it makes them feel guilty, but I think privilege is a powerful tool. You know, let's just talk about it. We're all different, that's okay. At the same time, we're also the same. We all want the same things. We didn't choose history, we didn't choose the families we were born into, but we're here now, so what are we going to do with our time? And with the privileges we have, how are we going to use those? And how are we going to recognize those in our lives with less privilege than ourselves, and what will we do to empower those individuals? And one really helpful exercise I always think of is naming my privilege. So I'm going to do it now, because you can all do this. So I am a cisgender woman. I identify with the body I was born into. I am heterosexual. And those two things alone are incredibly powerful. I have never had to worry about which bathroom to use. I have never had to worry about holding my husband's hand in public transport or when we're traveling in other countries. I was born into a house with educated parents. You know, I had books on the bookshelf when I was a kid. People taught me how to read. People read to me. That's a privilege. I got to go on family holidays. That's a privilege. I've been skiing. That's a privilege. It's really expensive. So, you know, the fact that I've got a university degree, the fact that English is my first language, the fact that I can articulate myself well, all of these things have given me an advantage in the workplace. Now, I am, of course, also black, right? And sometimes that's been an advantage, sometimes that hasn't been an advantage. So just doing that checklist is so powerful. It's so incredibly powerful. Yeah, the final thing I really wanted to say was think of how you can not only use privilege as a lens, but also how you can use that to identify communities either that you have an affinity with that will make you feel more safe and more empowered where you find yourself a minority otherwise, but also start to think about other communities you're not participating in, but whose voices should be heard and whose stories should be heard. So a really fun exercise I often say is, you know, who's missing from the table? Who's missing from the conversation? And you should be asking yourself that all the time. And you don't need to now go around London collecting friends from different races and identities, but you can listen to their podcasts, and you can read their books, and you can watch their shows, and you can immerse yourselves in the lives of others. And I think that's how we build empathy, and that's how we drive positive change instead of going back into the dark ages, which some folks are trying to do. I'm thinking of tangerine skin presidents and others like that. But yeah, that's sort of it from me, and I look forward to your questions.
So, handing over to Gary.
Thank you very much, and I hope you're okay with the Glaswegian accent. Let me start by asking all the males in the room to stand up. All the men. Why, I truly believe that inclusion and diversity is the foundation of building great companies, building great societies. And we're only going to take on the biases of the world and change the world if the men get it. Right, so I admire you guys being here. Listen, you learn a lot. And I actually remember one of my most terrifying experiences. I was in Deauville in the north of France at an international women's conference, and there was 2,000 women and 3 men. And I actually found myself having an argument with thousands of women around networks, because I think women's networks are fantastic. But if you're going to move the needle, you need to have men and women's networks, and they need to work collaboratively in changing things. Now, I believe experience frames your life, right? I'm from Glasgow, and when I was a baby, Glasgow was a microcosm of Northern Ireland, right? You were either a Catholic or you were a Protestant. And my mother and father, when they got together, my mother was a upper-class Protestant, my dad was a working-class Catholic, and my mother's father was a Grand Master of the Orange Lodge, which gave him a lot of power in the country. So when my mum made the unbelievable decision to marry my dad, nobody on my mum's side of the family showed up for the wedding. Right, and I had the privilege of being the first grandchild. And on the day I was born, my mum was very sick. And her father, the Grand Master, actually looked after me for 6 weeks. And at the end of that experience, when I was christened in a Catholic church, all the members of the Catholic and Protestant families came together and had a 3-day party celebrating me. It's about the only time I've been celebrated in my family. But, you know, and that was a great thing. And to this day, that man, he gave up his mastery of the Orange Lodge. He became an idol and a role model to me, and he helped bring our family together. And that got me thinking. So then as I got old, one of the other highlight experiences in my life is I met my wife, Marlene, about 33 years ago. And we were best friends for a year. And one iconic evening, 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd had a few drinks, as you do at LSE, and I asked her on a date. And without even flinching, she said, okay, if you want to have a date with me, there are 3 conditions. Right, you need to quit your job, buy a round the world ticket, and buy a place together. And I thought, Jesus, I'm only asking for a date. And talk about getting out of your comfort zone, that was fun. And, you know, within 12 weeks, we'd done all 3 of those things. We got engaged in Sydney Harbour in 1988, and I remember my wife saying to me, you know, Gary, I'm smarter than you are. I'm better with clients than you will ever be. So when we have our 5 children, I said 3, when we have our 5 children, you're going to stay at home and you're going to look after the kids. Right, and that's where you learn to pick your battles, you know, just stay silent. And of course, my wife, as I subsequently discovered, goes over budget on everything. So we didn't have 5 children, we had 6. And we didn't have 3 boys and 2 girls, which was the solution. We had 4 girls and 2 boys. Right, and these things, like, shape your experiences. And by the way, one of those girls is the captain of the LSE rugby team, and she considered got a greater purpose to be on the pitch today than to be here listening to me. So I joined Accenture. How many people have heard of Accenture? Probably nobody in this room, a few. So when I joined the company, we were a $2 billion company, 20,000 employees. When I left the company a few months ago, we were on our way to $50 billion, and we have 500,000 employees around the world. And I had the great privilege of working in many jobs, working in many companies, countries, adapting to many cultures, learning a lot of things about most of the world's great industries, and you know, how to make money and how to achieve purpose. And as I reflect on my experience with Accenture, one thing prevails above anything else, and that is that the best team always wins. Right, and having the best team means having a team that's relevant to your situation. Relevant from a content point of view, relevant from a cultural point of view, relevant in terms of who you are, what you represent, and building a real relationship with people across the other side of the table. And I remember one of my greatest ever learning experiences in Accenture about 6 years ago. I took on a part of the business. I was running our global telecoms and technology business, which was about a $5 billion business. And I absolutely, passionately believed that building the best team meant building the most inclusive team that represented our customers and our people. And I took the step of holding a meeting in Rome where I brought together 200 of our most highly relevant, highly skilled women, and I brought the 20 males who were running my company. And I actually asked an external player to do some research for me, ask a lot of questions. And so she interviewed hundreds and hundreds of our women and hundreds of our men. And I'll never forget, and I told her to give the feedback, just throw it out there as it was. And I remember her introduction. And she said to me, you know, the view of all the women, almost to a person, was that you invest a lot of money. Gary, you expose a lot of rhetoric about inclusiveness and diversity, but you take no action, nothing changes, you're not evoking any revolution in terms of the makeup of our team. And then you get the feedback from the men. We spent millions of dollars on inclusion programs, diversity programs, unconscious bias training programs. We've done everything possible. There's nothing else we can do. And this woman put up a chart showing the investment of all the millions we'd spent. And then she showed a line on the number of women in leadership positions as a percentage of the total population. And that line did not change. It didn't change one inch in 5 years, even though as a company we were spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on the program. And so I came out of that meeting. Firstly, it was an unbelievable learning experience for our men, sitting for 2 days with women around the world, listening to their views. But I came out of that day more convinced than ever that inclusion and diversity is a business issue, it's a societal issue, and unless you turn the dial, you will never be a great company. And I took that slide and I used it in every meeting around the world, and I put a headline on the top, which I used in many dimensions of business. And the headline said, never confuse activity with results. Right, we spend all this money, but we were doing nothing in terms of building an authentic leadership team and building an authentic company that was going to be fit for purpose for our customers around the world. And then behind that, we put a framework. So I went away and we developed with our men, with our women, a set of KPIs. And I ended up agreeing with my leadership team that actually changing the makeup of our leadership team, institutionalizing an environment of no bias, institutionalizing an environment of equal pay, equal promotions, etc., etc. And we actually made that one of our top three KPIs, and bonuses at the end of the year were based on some of this stuff. And it was a long road. Even with all of that, changing the DNA of the males and changing the DNA of the females was a journey. And it really took taking risks with people to change the world. Let me quickly, I've got 5 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Let me quickly change to International Women's Day. International Women's Day is a fantastic platform, and in the past has been great for shining the torch on bias, for shining the torch on societal issues, for shining the torch on great role models, great examples of women doing great things. But it was a little transactional. I think we're at a tipping point now where actually women and other gender, I mean, it's more than gender, this is every dimension of what makes up a team. But I think we're at a situation now where women need to influence the bigger picture. So yes, we gotta have inclusive and diverse workforces, but actually having a diverse team is gonna enable us to take on the bigger challenges. The gap between the rich and the poor and the haves and the have-nots, the economic inequalities around the world, the climate disaster. I mean, these issues will only be solved when you've got inclusive and diverse teams who've actually got experience, who actually understand the science, and who actually need to work collaboratively. Now, when we come back, so I think International Women's Day is really going to become an even greater platform for changing the world and changing the USA and other autocratic environments. I think the biggest gotcha, and this is where all of you guys have a huge, huge role to play, is we've got to get away from this inclusion and diversity as being a transactional issue. It really is at the heart of the DNA of how we live and how we work. And, you know, I've spoken to many CEOs in my own industry. You look at my industry, technology, telecommunications. Every CEO I talk to talks about the fact they need to improve their customer experience. They need to become more collaborative companies. They need to be more relevant to society that rather than just charging you for phone calls. And yet, if you look at how you change some of those big issues, you're not going to change them by having CTOs who are all male and don't believe there's any female engineers in the world. Right? And one of the great dangers, let me ask you all a question. How many people here have worked in service design or digital design? Not a single person. Right? I can tell you now, the Facebooks, the Googles, all these global giants that are changing the way that we live and are changing the way that we work and have huge impacts on everything you see around the world. We are in grave danger of creating a digital society that has more bias than the society we had before. And the reasons for that is all this great stuff you read about artificial intelligence and all the stuff you see in social media, a lot of the design thinking behind this has been done by men. How insane is that? You look at some of the stats that we heard from the previous speaker. Around 15% of startups in around the world are women. And actually, the co-founder numbers are even lower. So we're in danger of creating a digital society that's going to be even more biased and even more framed with unconscious bias than the one that we've been living all of these years. So one thing I'd say to all of you, you young people, and I know with my six kids, we meet together once a week. We have a family dinner. Giving advice is a two-way street. I listen more than I talk, which I know sounds strange. But it's your society. You guys are digital native. You know a lot more about how to fix these issues than we do. But it's going to take all of you. You mentioned that magical term, getting out of the comfort zone. Right, I'm very proud. One of my daughters was in the audience here, went and spent 3 weeks on a Palestinian refugee camp. Right, that experience framed a lot of our thinking. My daughter who's playing rugby, you know, went with my wife to a Human Rights Watch conference in South Africa a few weeks ago. You've got to get out there, experience, learn, listen, learn from your mistakes, and then have conviction in actually starting to have a voice in changing all of this stuff. And I believe in every single one of you, there is a hidden genius. And actually figuring out what your strengths are, what your convictions are, and what your impact's going to be in changing society, in changing the direction of your companies, it's down to you guys. And you got to have a voice, and you got to be outspoken, and you got to take risks, and you got to learn from your mistakes. But if this generation doesn't stand up, and I truly believe it will, we're going to be living with Trump plus 30 years from now. God help us all. So this inclusion and diversity is not a project, it's not a program. It's central to the DNA of the societies that we want to create into the future. So don't be shy, ask lots of questions, let's have a debate. Because this is not about us, this is down to you guys.
Gary Abadesi, Steph, thank you so much. You've given us such brilliant insights. I'm going to now open the floor to questions from the audience. If you could say your name and affiliation and then wait for the stewards with the roving microphones to get to you. Do we have a first question? Yes. Thank you. Thanks so much for the talks. They were fantastic.
Hello, my name's Kaylee. I am a graduate student here at LSE in health policy. I wanted to know from ideally each of you, if there's time, how mentorship plays a role in making the changes that you've all spoken about.
So, who wants to begin? Steph, mentorship, yeah.
Yeah, can you hear me okay, yeah? For me, it's been really, really key. I think, you know, I slightly touched on that idea that you've just got to have good people around you and you've got to reach, actually be proactive and reach out and seek people. You know, I have been known to pick the phone up and say, hi, would you be my mentor? Because there are times when it's really tough, and actually just to try and do things by yourself is, and it can feel by yourself even when you're not actually. And so to have good people around you who can challenge you compassionately or otherwise, and to get you to think slightly differently and to keep you motivated is really, really important. So I think that's been really, really key in me being able to keep pushing forward with the things that I want to do, both sort of as an individual, as a business owner, and sort of wider than that. So yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think it's really important.
I think mentorship's also been really valuable for me, but what's been even more powerful is sponsorship. And I think there's a big difference between giving someone advice and creating opportunities for somebody. So I'm really interested in sponsorship, and you know, the more underrepresented you are in your workplace by every dimension of your identity, whether that's your race, your gender, your background, your sexual orientation, your education level, your language abilities, neurodiversity, etc., the more you actually need sponsorship, because a mentor can only do so much. But it's people who hold power, whether they're decision makers, hiring managers, etc., who can really change your life. And I think that's why sponsorship is really interesting. And just to give you a real life example, the first year I ran my company, I was bootstrapping, so I was literally running it full time, trying to make ends meet. And when I did my first year of accounts, I realized that I had only ever issued invoices to women of color. And that showed me that it was only women of color who understood the problem that I was solving and who were willing to invest in it. And I actually attended a talk at Google and shared that story, and I said, hey, you know, I'm still waiting for a white guy to believe in this and believe that this matters. And the next day I got a call from an investor, and he said, I am introducing you to a client. And that's actually one of my longest running clients so far. So mentorship is great, so the sponsorship is even better.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think mentorship is absolutely core to the success of most companies. But I would tell you that my experience is mentorship doesn't work very well in most companies. The mentor very often sees it as a transaction, sees it as an obligation. So my advice to you is be very, very challenging in who you pick as a mentor. You want to have people that are mentoring you with real experience, with real conviction, and who will tell you how it is, not tell you what you want to hear. I completely agree with sponsorship, but I would separate the two. I mean, my proudest achievement at Accenture was I made 385 managing directors over the last 20 years. Only 33% of them women, but it got better over time. And I tell you, mentorship and sponsorship was at the core of the success of many of those people. But you need to be very, very challenging. If a mentor's not working out, find another one. And I often think that the best mentorship you'll ever get is the informal mentorship. Right, so spread your wings, get yourself multiple mentors that are going to bring advice from a different set of experiences. And then the final thing I would say is, beyond mentorship and sponsorship, is that magical word, network. Right? Network is the new meritocracy. Actually getting out your comfort zone and building a real network of peers and people from different experiences is also a must.
And just one other thing, I think mentoring can be really interesting, and this perhaps is different again, but it can work really well when it's like mutual mentoring, because actually, yeah, I've got lots I want to learn from you, which is why I've gone to you, but actually that's not to say there's nothing you can learn from me either. So I think this idea of like mutual mentoring can be quite useful in some contexts when there's actually, you know, my lived experience can be very influential if I choose to present it in that way, and so it's more two-way, that can be good too.
Yep, agree.
Next question, yeah.
Hi, my name's Amy. I'm on a diversity scheme at a large publishing house, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on graduate diversity schemes and whether they actually work in the long term.
Oh, well, I was on a diversity scheme, and it's the only way I could have got the FT on my CV. I like to think of it like this. Imagine solving a problem that's millennia old. It's nigh on impossible, so I feel as though until it's solved, everything should be tried and everything should be measured. You know, he made the point earlier that you have to put results on something and you have to put stats on something for it to work. And if you're a company that's committed to increasing representation of women, of people who are black and brown, of people who are disabled, and one experiment you try to do that is creating a scheme, and if that scheme succeeds in increasing representation of those people, fantastic. Is it the only solution you should try? Absolutely not. And I just think all companies should be open to trying things that increase representation at every level.
Steph, do you wanna?
I don't think I've got anything in addition, really, that makes sense to me.
No, I mean, I think you need to look at where you are as in your evolution as a company. So we used diversity programs and diversity schemes very early on when we were trying to eliminate unconscious bias. We were trying to educate people on the need to build more inclusive and direct, more inclusive workforces. But I agree. There's this magical thing, this magical word called authentic leaderships. Too many diversity schemes lack that authenticity. And if you look again at the way the world is working, you look at the impact of digital, you'll hear as you get into the business world, these terms, agile, you gotta be agile in everything you do. Right? You gotta work across silos and work in collaborative teams. Ultimately, the diversity programs need to be overtaken with how you train and how you teach your people and how you guys become curious and learn from your mistakes and learn every day from things you do. I think they have a role, but I think too many of them lack authenticity.
Thank you. Perfect. Do we have a next question?
Yeah,
here in the front.
Hi, Jasmine from Global Giving. I didn't go to LSE, I wish I did. So I guess I'm gonna ask not a question, but for some words of encouragement for everyone else. So I've worked at a couple of startups, and I like to think of myself as a pretty good professional. And I worked in these amazing campuses, which I got all this really badass work done, and I was like, yeah, this is amazing. And then I would always have a very high-powered boss who would say something so sexist and so unbelievable to me that I wasn't even sure that it actually happened. And I had no one to turn to because they're startups, there's no HR department, there's no legal consequences or anything really that I could really do about it except go cry to my manager who'd also experienced the same thing. So I guess what I'm saying is this is gonna happen to these people and they're gonna find it really hard in that moment and in that point in time when they realize that in theory they're there for the right reasons. But it doesn't matter how good they are professionally, it's still gonna happen. So is there anything you can say to them when that happens, what to do, and how to get past it?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I feel like the difference between the scenario you've described happening, let's say 10 or 15 years ago, and the difference between that happening now is that Me Too happened, and it happened at a global scale, and we all know what it is, and we can all call it out now. And we can have conversations like consent. I have teenage cousins talking to me about consent, and I was like, whoa, I didn't know that was a word when I was your age and, you know, starting to have my first relationships. So I feel that there is power in calling out what is not appropriate. And that's something that we as women living now have the privilege to do that women before couldn't do. You know, there are women now, they're like, oh, it was different in the 70s, it was different in the 80s. I mean, you know, it's still your body, it's still your property. So if you find yourself in a situation at work where someone in a position of power is abusing their power for their own nefarious reasons, then, you know, you have a really good case for basically calling it out and saying, I don't feel comfortable with this. That's what I would probably do. But I mean, it's difficult, right? Because at the same time, I don't know what your bank balance is. I don't know what your employment prospects are. And the reality is a lot of people are being discriminated against, are being harassed, and they do not have a choice. And that's why I do the work that I do. So I also don't want to pretend it's really easy and it's great. Like, I've been in that situation and all you want to do is cry, and we've got a long way to go.
Steph, do you want to?
Yeah, I think my general, for me personally, my general sense in terms of answering is that if you're experiencing discrimination quite regularly, clearly that's not acceptable, but I feel like I almost have to look after myself as well, so that I can't take on every time something is unfair or discriminatory or I'm excluded. You know, I can't do that all the time because it is exhausting. And so there's something for me which I'm always striving to do, and I'm not always the best at, but you have to look after yourself. You have to look after your mental health, and so I have to pick my battles. So if it's outrageous and if it's extremely unacceptable, then I can't accept that. Clearly, I can't. But there are some times when, you know, you have to let just some things go because you are only one person, and that can become a bit too overwhelming, and it's not good for you to take on everything all the time. So I suppose I'll try and put in perspective what I can do, and when I'm feeling strong and able to challenge something, and not to beat myself up if I don't do it every single time. I think there's something about your networks and perhaps mentoring and things where that can come in, particularly if within those you've got people with shared lived experience who really know what that feels like in a way in which other really well-meaning people don't always in quite the same way. So I think, you know, I've found that to be really helpful and to help me perhaps even decide whether it's a battle I want to pick or otherwise. I think there's a lot there, and I agree with what's been said, but I think on a very personal level, I think you just have to pick your battles sometimes, and you have to think wider than just you, but then you also have to think of you, and if you taking something on is going to have an adverse effect on your ability to function well going forward, you know, just that needs to be part of your consideration about taking a grievance forward.
So I would say, I mean, I've unfortunately been involved in many dozens of situations over the years, and I would have a zero tolerance attitude towards this, and that's not to undermine the difficulty of the situation. So I'd say a few things. Firstly, as you walk out today, think about mentor, sponsor, network, because you want to start building around yourself all the mechanisms to allow you to have difficult conversations with people that you have relationships with and people that trust. I can tell you, I don't come from the startup world, but nothing will destroy value more for a corporation than a corporation that's not on top of its ethics and its values. And certainly in companies like ours, there was zero tolerance. And the third thing I would say, just from a startup mentality, and I know it's not easy because there are many other considerations, but I would call it out. I would call it out immediately, because my experience is if it exists and it doesn't get called out, it's only going to get worse. And that may mean taking decisions that are going to hurt you at the front end, but you're not going to compromise your values. And I think ultimately, you will win. You may lose the battle, but you'll win the war, because there is no room for that kind of discrimination of behaviour in any company. I don't care whether it's a startup or a corporation.
Yeah, and I think that sounds like we're just being contradictory, but I don't think we have, because I do second what you've just said. I just think if you receiving exclusion, discriminatory stuff really regularly, then I just don't think you can every single time. And I said live by your values and be true to yourself. But I think there's a piece just about looking after yourself as well. But I do agree with what you just said, Gary.
There was a question there.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
Perfect. Is this a hard question?
Hi, I'm Chiara. I work for Intercontinental Hotel Groups and Diversity Inclusion Team. I have a question about your view on What do you think of linking the diversity within a team to the senior leaders' performance and bonus thing? So it's something you do in your companies, do you think it works? Or, you know, because I think, you know, diversity and inclusion is, everyone is responsible to it and it cannot be mandate. But how do we create this accountability and responsibility from senior managers to not just talk, but actually act and be measured against diversity?
McKinsey do a really good Women in the Workplace report every year, and off the back of the research speaking to different organizations and measuring the impact of diversity inclusion over time, one of the number one learnings is that change will only happen if it happens top down. And I think, I'm sure Gary will go on about this, until you put a metric on it, people aren't really accountable to it. So I'm a big believer in that. And to give you an example, over a six-year period from 2006 to 2012, Google spent over $40 million on diversity and inclusion efforts, and representation across the company went down. There were fewer black people, there were fewer women, fewer LGBTQIA+. If you compare that to a company like Cisco that started linking end-of-year bonuses to hiring managers having 50-50 gender representation at every round of hiring, and actually being incentivized to increase representation on their teams, boom, over a 2 to 3 year period, immediately representation increased. So I'm a big believer in it.
It's about whether you should include a diversity in CEO remuneration, so whether you should, you know, have a target on it and they get bonuses in relation to it.
Okay. I think that Gary slightly touched on this idea that, you know, it needs to be business as usual, it needs to be part of your organization's DNA, and so therefore it follows that, you know, it needs to be treated in the way in which it's credible and it's meaningful, and if it means that it's remunerated because it's valued in that respect, then yeah, maybe.
So, you know, honestly, I think any board, I actually think board members who, by the way, appoint CEOs should take a course before they become a board member. Because if board members don't understand that building an inclusive and diverse workforce creates stronger and faster and more impactful innovation, right? It creates multiples increase in customer satisfaction, in employee satisfaction, and ultimately in bottom line results. Right, and so when you're choosing a CEO, and again, I go back to Accenture, we now have a CEO who's a woman. Right, we have a published a report that says we will be 50-50 across our 500,000 people by 2025. So yes, you got to then underpin that with hard measures, with real KPIs, linking those KPIs to how senior people are paid. But you've also, as a board member, got to look at the softer, but for me, even more important stuff, which is, are you creating the culture of diversity? Are you leveraging new technologies to solve problems like, you know, work-life balance, inevitable family commitments, et cetera, et cetera? So I think it's again, this is not a gimmick. This is one of the levers on how you lead or lose as a company.
We have another question. Yeah, here at the back.
Hi, my name is Emmy. I don't have an affiliation with the LSE. I'm a commercial marine insurance broker. I have a question for Gary particularly. You said that Accenture spent millions on their diversity programs. I was wondering if you also spent millions in measuring those metrics afterwards, after you started to make your teams more diverse. I think something that I've incorporated a lot in my professional life is an idea that, of course, we all want to be fair, but having metrics to show that more diverse teams are successful, what do we define as success? Do we define that as high customer reviews after, if you were in consulting, higher amounts of brokerage, what could that be? And if Accenture, as their Fortune 500 company, has released these results, or if maybe you have any ideas, any of the three of you.
I'm getting old, right? So I got about 60% of that. Can you just summarize the question?
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. It's me. It's not you. It's me.
I can make it shorter. Have you publicly released metrics of your teams after they become more diverse, their performance, to highlight that they do better,
yep,
that they're more diverse?
So, to me, you get, in any company, you get what you measure. People behave the way they're measured. Right, so I'm a great believer. One of the greatest weapons you have as a leader is the weapon of transparency. So if I'm going to tackle an issue, and if it's an issue around inclusion and diversity, I'm going to have a report every month showing me the evolution of what's going on. I'm going to hold people personally accountable for those metrics. I'm going to distribute those metrics to everybody. So that, you know, I mean, all of these things are both associated with individual leadership actions, but I'm a great believer in collective accountability. So if you're going to say you're going to do something, you need to measure it. You need to prove whether you're doing well or not. And if you're not, what are you doing about it? Did I answer the question? Because I'm not sure I answered it.
You answered most of it, but I think there was also a question of publication, so whether you actually, when you were at Accenture, whether you published the results.
So on publication, there is corporate publication, where you'd be very, very careful about what you publish and when you publish it, but certainly in Accenture's case, we would publish, you know, a number of measures, including number of women in board seats, number of women on the executive, number of women in the company. And then from a more tactical, me running my $6 billion business, I would have no issue at all in distributing all of the metrics to all of my people. Because you either have conviction on what you say you're going to do, or it's Mickey Mouse, it's not authentic, it's not taking anybody anywhere.
Hi, I'm Libo and I'm a software developer in the energy industry. I was interested in understanding, so with diversity, it's easy to see, or relatively easy to see, that a team or a company is diverse in terms of gender or race or things like that. What are some of the ways that you can meaningfully measure inclusive behavior or inclusive teams?
The question is, what are meaningful ways to measure whether a company culture is inclusive? It might be easy to see if a team is diverse, but how do you know if it's inclusive? So there's a really good quote, I can't remember who in the tech industry said it, but it said something like, diversity is inviting everyone to the party and inclusion is making sure everybody dances. And I think when we look at companies that have good, healthy retention of people underrepresented within the organization or underrepresented within the industry, what you see they've done is focus on belonging. So Airbnb is a really great example of a company that has a department for belonging. And the idea behind that is to create a function which is responsible for making sure each individual, regardless of their background, regardless of their identity, feels like they belong and feels like they can thrive there, and most importantly, feels like they can be their true self there. So I can wear my hair however I want, I can eat whatever food I want, don't care how it smells, I can talk about whatever I want, and I don't expect to be treated any differently to anybody else. So for me, there are those markers. You know, is there someone who's responsible for ensuring each person feels like they belong here? Where does that responsibility fall? Ideally, it will be someone at an executive level, because that means they have power, it means they have a budget. You can't do much without money in capitalism. And the other thing I would look for is retention. You know, go to the people who are Black, Brown, LGBTQIA+, disabled, parents, and ask them how long they've worked at the company. And if everyone who has long tenure belongs to one identity group, and all the people who are interesting and different have been there 3 months, that's a red flag.
It's interesting. I was just going to say that inclusion is being asked to dance thing, you know? That struck me when I heard the question too. I think the reality is it's more difficult to analyze and monitor and be aware of, because it is more of a sense. And diversity, I think, is easier to monitor. And that isn't to say, therefore, that you can't. And I think there is something about, I've just come from an organization actually, whereby they do this, they look at, they have very, very low staff turnover, generally, and it's because they do a lot of this stuff, but they do actually drill down to the backgrounds of people and the types of people, because they monitor the diversity and include that together in terms of inclusion, but I think you can ask questions really in basic terms in staff surveys, in appraisals. You can craft questions and use that those responses to get a sense of and how inclusive an organisation is, whether people would recommend working there to some of their friends with shared lived experience. There are ways, but I think it is more difficult, and I think when you get it right, I think it's almost a feeling, it's a sense.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard a lot tonight about gender diversity, but as you say, there are many, many elements of inclusiveness, from disabled to LGBT to colour to culture. And again, as a company, we measured a lot of these things. As you say, when you're in a people business, it's not rocket science. It's about who you attract, how well you retain them, and then most importantly of all, their pace of development. And I agree that having champions, so we would have champions for colour or for LGBT, et cetera, having champions is helpful, but ultimately you want to hold business owners accountable for building diverse and inclusive workforces. And I always found the best source of feedback was A, from our clients, because for us, our top 1,000 clients around the world had the same diversity and inclusion issues as we had, so we specifically asked them, and then from our employees, because if people are not feeling they're in a company that gets it, like you say, they're not going to stick around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect, thank you for those answers.
Hi, hello everyone. So my name is August. I just started my career in this big IT company. And so through all of my life and growing up, I was always in tech, follow tech, and so conferences, hackathons, startups, wow, startup hubs, and I was just having so much fun. Life was so beautiful. I just thought, why more girls are not here? Because it's so much fun and like tech is so interesting. And if you would have started spoken to me about something like unconscious biasness, or I would have probably stopped listening because I had no clue what it is, because I was just, I never experienced that until I started my professional career. And so now everything gets to seat at the table and promotions and compensations, and it's a total different story. And now I'm aware of the facts, aware of why these things are happening and when it actually affects me on a major way. And so I'm just sitting at a table with a lot of men and just a couple of girls, noticing all of these little things and unconscious bias, and considering how it's gonna affect me, a young female professional in a tech career. And so it gets me wondering that probably these men also have no clue about these unconscious bias. So my question would be, how do you start talking about it in your company, with your teammates, especially when it's a fast-growing company and nobody has time for these things? Everyone just cares about sales and growing. Hopefully without hurting your career or possibility of promotion or so on.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and I feel like Steph's words are really echoing in my mind, because we do have to pick our battles at work, and one of the most frustrating things about being an underrepresented person, particularly in a tech startup where you have a time constraint, you have a budget constraint, and you're trying to win at all costs, is that you find yourself being the champion for your identity within the company, which is really an HR function, when you should be there delivering on the goals you've been hired to deliver on. So I always felt really conflicted in my experience in startups, where it's like I was actually always in a business development function, which meant I had to be closing deals, but because I was also the only woman or black woman on the sales team, I also had to talk about why it wasn't okay for people to use my hair as a stress ball, which one man really once did over and over again. So I guess what I want to say to you is, instead of having the conversation yourself, why don't you just start like sharing resources or sharing articles or sharing podcasts about it, so you can have the conversation by proxy, And, you know, when companies want to get better at SEO, they bring in an SEO consultant. If you want to get better at diversity and inclusion, hire a diversity and inclusion consultant. Reading one article by a black lesbian woman won't make you woke. And I've met so many CEOs and CTOs that are like, oh, I read why I no longer talk to white people about race, so we're good. And I'm just like, but you're not. So, you know, I'm really empowered by what you've said, and I think it's so encouraging that you've identified this and you're thinking about it. But, you know, to the point that Steph made earlier, it's not your battle. So, you know, leverage other things that are out there to start the conversation.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I'll just echo a lot of what you've just said, because actually, you know, the tech world isn't my world, so I can't answer specifically in that, but just to talk more generally, I think when you are underrepresented and you are there as somebody who could speak with credibility in terms of lived experience, you are often the go-to person, and actually that isn't always who I want to be. Like, sometimes I do, but not always. I don't think it's fair that should be an assumption, and I don't think it's right that I should take that on because of who I am, whatever that might be, actually. And so I think there's something there about, unfortunately, that then means that you have to deal with that. And how you deal with that, again, I go back to picking your battles, because it is just something I'm really conscious about, is, you know, sometimes I will and I'm happy to, and sometimes I don't want to and I'm not prepared to. But I think the unconscious bias thing is quite interesting, because if you, having difficult conversations is difficult, clearly. And I think the thing with unconscious bias is that we all have them. So actually, it isn't that you're dreadful and I'm perfect. We all have them. And so that can be quite a leveler in terms of having a conversation if you want to. I found that anyway, in that, you know, once I started to learn much more about unconscious biases, because I think, you know, early on in my career, I certainly had never heard of it, but I don't think I'd ever even noticed it in myself or other people, particularly, like, I'm going back now. So I think to kind of recognize it in yourself, because we all have them, can be a way to start some of those conversations if you choose to. So that topic is quite interesting in that respect, because it isn't about lived experience then, because we all have biases. And so we all need to be mindful of them at the very least. And so having a conversation that's coming from a place that this is inherent in all of us can be a bit easier in starting a difficult conversation if you choose to and you want to and you don't quite know where to start.
I think I'd say, firstly, the personality in the first half of that question should be sitting up here, because I love that style. And secondly, you know, in the tech environment, tech leaders are being called out. Like, tech companies, even the best tech companies in the world, are being called out. Their number one issue right now is trust. Digital trust, employee trust, trust around data. And again, I slightly disagree, but it's not your accountability. Yes, boards and CEOs, if they don't get, as I've said, I sound like a broken record, but if they don't get that building, you know, inclusiveness is critical to long-term shareholder value, then they will fail. But I believe you guys are a young generation. There's so much opportunity out there, whether you're in a startup or whether you're in a, you know, a bigger company. Do your homework, right? Because if companies are not taking this seriously, if you look at the great tech companies, a Satya Nadella at Microsoft or a Mark Benioff at Salesforce, not only are they publishing and being open book on inclusion and diversity, you'll find a lot of these CEOs also, you know, trying to get those companies famous for being a force for good in society. You know, in Benioff, he's introduced a 1% tax on the west coast of the US to eliminate homelessness. Satya Nadella. So if these companies don't have values, ethics, ambition, purpose, as well as open book and transparency in some of these issues, you're probably working for the wrong company and you should probably tell them. And if you've got a network and a mentor and a sponsor, you'll have tons of options. Call them out.
Right, we've got time for just one last question, but it needs to be quite quick, yeah, because we're finishing at 8.
Hi, my name is Julie, and I was the participant of Harrow, and...
Sorry, I missed that.
HERA. She's part of the HERA program.
Ah, okay.
So, one of the many women has been supported. Sorry, I just get a little bit.
Oh, amazing.
I did an MBA, an executive MBA, and their pitch was very, very good, fully, slides on everything, budget, marketing, pricing. They've done a really good job. So
incredible.
Julie's part of that winning team, and she fights every single day to show up and ask a question.
Thanks for being here,
brilliant.
Julie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we need
you've got a good sponsor and mentor.
Yes.
Because we had the first hand experience of inequality. Sorry, I just didn't realize it suddenly became so.
Yeah.
But I want to have a voice for. Because we can experience the multi layer of the inequality. But we still have our, dream, our motivation to fight for the equality, to set up a business, and I'm looking for the job during the job interview. But what's the advice you can give us to as the more vulnerable people in the society to be more resourceful and creative to fight for our equality? Thank you.
That's a really great question.
Yeah.
I work in the tech industry. I'm an entrepreneur myself. It's so challenging to be in a risky environment and be a vulnerable person because, more than other people, if you've been a victim of trauma, you need psychological safety. And the frustrating thing about being an underrepresented person in the workplace is you're very unlikely to be guaranteed that. Because to have psychological safety in a space, you need people that can empathize with your situation. And if that isn't by virtue of having lived through it themselves, it's at least by having had an opportunity to immerse themselves in the stories of people like yourself. So the first thing I want to say is, don't spend too much time worrying about prioritizing your productivity and your resourcefulness, because from what I'm hearing, you're doing an incredible job of that. I think the first thing you should be doing is also just prioritizing your mental health and your psychological safety as you operate in a very competitive environment. And then the second thing I would say is community is everything. So when I first started my business, I was basically doing it because no one would give me a reference and no one would hire me. I was also about to be deported by the Home Office for a really long story that I'll tell you another time. And my husband had just been made redundant. And so, everyone's been through strife. Everyone knows what it is, but it's really, really hard. And I think when I found myself at what I would say a low point, while still trying to pursue opportunities and still strive for more, what really helped me was immersing myself in the communities where I felt safe to share the struggles I was going through and where people were there to listen to me, hear me, and then also help me. And I think it can be extremely isolating to be an entrepreneur, and it can be extremely isolating to be a vulnerable person. And if you just always go back into those communities and those spaces, I would love to go for coffee with you, by the way, so let's please exchange numbers because I want to help you. That's what you need. You need to balance that hard work with you time, and that you time often happens in communities where you feel safe or with other people who can relate to your experience, who can make you, you know, feel appreciated. Yeah.
And it's really inspiring. You're able to actually step up and talk as you just did. Right, there's nothing more inspiring for a company and for the employees in a company to hear stories like yours. I think the whole mental health, we could spend a lot of time talking about mental health. I think it's another one of those, you know, topics that you know, we're learning by doing, and it's affecting a lot more people in the workplace than we know. So you're getting through it amazing, and the fact that you've got people who understand your story. You know, people within your own communities are going to get inspired by you, and your confidence is going to increase step by step.
Yeah, I think these things can be a slow burn, and I think at events like this, because of the time constraints, if nothing else, it can be easy to make it all sound really simple. You know, it's really easy, you know, it's just this and this, and I've read this, and do you know that? And actually, you know, it's way more complex than that, and our lived experience is... It's tricky, and it doesn't all come dead easy. You know, I stand there and make it sound really easy. It's not. It's really not easy, and it's not easy for anyone, but there are some of us for whom it's particularly difficult for, and actually just to come here today, you know, is difficult, and to ask a question is difficult, and trust me, to answer a question is difficult. You know, we're all complex people. We don't all know everything, and it sometimes appears like that. We don't. We're all just finding our way and doing our best, and our best is usually good enough, you know? But it's difficult, and for all the things that have been said, particularly around networks and community and shared lived experience, can really be that catalyst that can help keep you on track and feeling good. And this is true of everyone. I mean, I'm talking to the person who asked the question, but really I'm talking to everybody, because we're all just human beings doing our very best, and actually, you know, that is good enough, and it sounds like you're doing amazing, and I love to continue chatting, hearing your world and your conversations, and really glad you're here on behalf of HERA tonight.
Yeah, thank you for a really inspiring last question. I think that was a really great note on which to end. I think it summed up some of the themes. So I was quite inspired by the way that you've been inspired by the social model of disability and the structural barriers of gender inequality and other forms of inequality. So we've heard a lot about structural barriers and how those hold people back, but at the same time about the ways in which the actions of individuals and organizations can transform those. So I think that those two things together, an appreciation that the barriers that you face are not your fault, but at the same time that you have some agency, and certainly within organizations there are people with agency who can change those things. I think that's a really important thing that we've had tonight. I'm so grateful to our speakers who've just done an absolutely amazing job. So let's thank them. But you have also been an absolutely fantastic audience with really brilliant questions. We're so happy to invite you here to the LSE tonight, even though I forgot its name when I was first introducing it, bizarrely. And if you want to join us, you're most welcome. We've got a reception in the basement of the Garrick restaurant, which is just down the road from here. So you go out of the building and you turn right? So yes, you're welcome to join us. So thanks once again, and hope to see you at another event again at LSE. Bye.